don't have any flashy title again here tonight because we're sort of entrenched in this section of First Chronicles about David. We've been calling these portions of the series an idealized David. And this is actually part five of that series as we're, Lord willing, going to go through three chapters here tonight of this section, leaving us the concluding aspects of this. This goes all the way through chapter 29. Lord willing, we'll go 18, 19, and 20. We'll be able to get through that tonight. Chapter 21, you're going to read about. If you want to read in advance, you'll see that chapter 1 covers the biggest failure that's recorded of David in First Chronicles. As this being an idealized David that's being presented here, a lot of his failures are not highlighted, but that's a big one, and it's very costly, so you can look forward to that, read ahead. And then chapters 22 through 29, those seven chapters, I think we'll be able to cover all at once, because those chapters focus on all of the variety of different preparations that David is able to make toward the end of his life for the temple being built by his son Solomon. So that's what you have to look forward to. Probably about two more sections here, two more lessons after tonight in First Chronicles, and then we'll be in Second Chronicles. And again, Chronicles is the longest book in the Old Testament, so we'll have done a good dent, I guess, or made a good dent in the Old Testament by going through these two books. But as we think about this, an idealized David, I just want to remind those of you who maybe haven't been here for other parts of the series that these chapters, picking up where the end of Saul's life ends in chapter 10 and then moving through chapter 11 through 29, about the summary of David's life. And we talked about and we've mentioned that to idealize somebody is to represent them as perfect or better than they were in reality. Now, if you want to be using a human illustration of a coming perfect king, and that's what David was, a picture of a future king who would come who would be perfect, well then, even painting him in the best light doesn't measure up to the perfect King of Kings, God himself, the Messiah, Jesus Christ, in any real similarity. It's just a way to picture it, but it's not all of that similar. And so you think about the author of the Chronicler, the effort was to sort of hit the high points and to portray David in the best light possible as a picture of this coming king. And that's hard to do. It's hard to give supernatural examples when you're just a natural person. It's hard to speak in terms of the infinite when you're finite. It's hard to talk about the eternal realm when you're temporal. And so there's so many areas of the Bible that are hard to sort of illustrate or picture or explain other than to use some kind of a human term. And that's why oftentimes we struggle even to understand God as he really is, because we take and we personify God with human emotions, human experiences, human understanding, and God's so much bigger than that. And that's why oftentimes we never have like a full understanding or a useful understanding of God, because we've always figured out a way to make him smaller than God actually is. And so that's a separate point. But what the Chronicler has been doing for this post-exilic community is to try to have this looking backward summary of David, not because he cares that much about David per se, although that's a big part of the history of the nation of Israel, but it's this picture being presented of this hope, this reason for hope, a story in search of an ending, this idea that it seems kind of bad right now, and you've gone through things even worse. This is actually slightly better than that, but this isn't how the story ends. The story is filled with hope, and it has this better ending because it's tied to the coming of the one who can make right everything that's been broken. And even if you think about the storyline of the Bible and even how Revelation ends, you could summarize Revelations in a number of ways, but God makes right, God fixes, God restores finally what was broken. He settles all accounts. That's a way to think about it. And this in part is doing this, but it's doing it in this, I want to give you reasons for hope looking forward. So it's a story in search of an ending, and that's what we've been sort of working our way through. And I know at times some of the subject matter, even the things tonight, maybe don't make an obvious connection to that, but it would have for the nation of Israel, who is looking back, coming out of exile, coming back from captivity and bondage, coming back to this partial restoration and seeing that this isn't anything like what we experienced in the heyday of the nation. But yet God says the future is very bright because he's a promise-making God and a promise-keeping God. And we've been talking about that a little bit as we were talking about God's covenant promises and how much of the Bible has that framework then that helps us understand it as we think about these promises that God made. A lot of the subject matter is then how God makes a promise. Now, how is he going to fulfill that? And so a lot of the subject matter of the storyline answers those questions. And so I hope some of that's falling into place. I'm learning more about it just even as I'm studying it. So now we're going to look at picking up in chapter 18. I do want to review just a little bit, not want to spend much time on it, but chapter 11 started with the early days of David's rule. Chapter 12 touched on the growth of David's army. Chapter 13, the ark is remembered. And I think that was very encouraging or very informative for me, that chapter, this idea that in the days of Saul, nobody was inquiring of the Lord is sort of the takeaway. The spiritual health of the nature of the nation was not good. And you think about how easy it is to fall into that in our own lives, where you have this posture of just going through the motions and going through the routines of life. But you, if you're being honest, you'd say, I'm not involving God in that. I'm not inquiring of God as I go about making all of these decisions. And part of that is because we just have never learned to do that. We've never seen God as a real personal and present God that we have access to all of the time. We just don't see it that way. Because if we did, we would talk to him. We would inquire of him. We would be interested in what he has to say, even through his word. And we don't have the appropriate amounts of any of that from God's perspective as in the sense of an ideal or desired kind of a mentality. So the ark is remembered, chapter 13. David's reign is solidified in chapter 14. Chapter 15, the ark is second try. The ark is brought to Jerusalem. Jerusalem is set up as the center of government for the nation. Jerusalem is set up as a center of worship for the nation of Israel. It's ground zero now for God's present plans, but also future plans, even as you think about the millennial kingdom and the importance of Jerusalem in that. Chapter 16, we see that the Lord is exalted and worship is promoted, which had not consistently been the case. And in fact, you can find very few examples of that ever being the case in the nation of Israel, where anybody actually took in what God had to say, valued it highly, and responded in faith to God's truth, and made that sort of the center they were going to weave their life around, or have their life revolve around that. The hub of their life, so to speak, is God's truth. You're not going to find that very often. Small little examples of it, but not a lot. So David, again, we're idealizing his reign because that wasn't true even in the reign of David all the way through or consistently. And he wasn't that great of an example at times to even the people. But yet God says, I want to be the center of this. I want to be the focal point in this. And so you see some elements of that looking backwards, summarizing this time of success in chapter 16. Then we saw the Davidic covenant, taking up our lesson for chapter 17 about the Davidic covenant, and I'm not going to rehash that. If you missed that, go look up those messages. There was a standalone message on an overview of covenants in general. Then there was a full message just on the specifics of the Davidic covenant. And that would sort of bring you up to speed with where we're at right now. So these three chapters tonight, you're saying, how are you going to get through three chapters? It's because we're not going to dig too deep into this. But these three chapters talk about David's reign and conquests. David's reign and conquests, they're summarized here. And then we're going to see that there's actually going to be a significant leap forward. About 20 years of his life, there's going to be a gap from this time period that we're talking about now, where there's these military successes, there's these, how does David go about administering his kingdom? Who are some of the people that are key figures in that? And then it's going to jump forward as you think about the events that happen in chapter 21. So be prepared for that. As we're summarizing his life, there's a good chunk here of gap between chapter 20 and chapter 21. But let's start with chapter 18. David expands the territory of Israel with God's empowerment. David expands the territory of Israel with God's empowerment. And that's going to be these first 13 verses, but it's also going to be a whole bunch of chapters 19 and 22. And so you're going to see some references that are going to push us forward a little bit farther into these chapters, maybe a little bit out of sequence. But the overall thought is that the focus is going to be on how David expands the territory of Israel. And a key part in this is with God's empowerment. So let's just read these first 13 verses. After this, it came to pass. Now, after what? After this Davidic covenant, these promises were made to David. After this, it came to pass that David attacked the Philistines, subdued them, and took Gath and its towns from the hand of the Philistines. Then he defeated Moab, and the Moabites became David's servants and brought tribute. And David defeated Hadadezer, king of Zobah, as far as Hamath. And again, don't ever repeat my pronunciations of this. I'm not sure what they are. He went to establish his power by the river Euphrates. David took from him 1,000 chariots, 7,000 horsemen, and 20,000 foot soldiers. Also David hamstrung all the chariot horses, except that he spared enough of them for 100 chariots. When the Syrians of Damascus came to help Hadadezer, king of Zobah, David killed 22,000 of the Syrians. Then David put garrisons in Syria of Damascus, and the Syrians became David's servants and brought tribute. So the Lord preserved David wherever he went, and I hope that's jumping off the page at you. Verse 7, and David took the shields of gold that were on the servants of Hadadezer and brought them to Jerusalem. Also from Tibhath and from Chun, cities of Hadadezer, David brought a large amount of bronze, with which Solomon made the bronze sea, the pillars, and the articles of bronze in the temple, is what that's a reference to. Verse 9. Now then, Tua, king of Hamath, heard that David had defeated all the army of Hadadezer, king of Zobah. He sent Hadoram, his son, to King David to greet him and bless him because he had fought against Hadadezer and defeated him, for Hadadezer had been at war with Tua. And Hadoram brought with him all kinds of articles of gold, silver, and bronze. King David also dedicated these to the Lord, along with the silver and gold that he had brought from all these nations, from Edom, from Moab, from the people of Ammon, from the Philistines, and from Amalek. Moreover, Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, killed 18,000 Edomites in the Valley of Salt. He also put garrisons in Edom, and all the Edomites became David's servants, and the Lord preserved David wherever he went. Now, try saying Hadadezer a bunch of times, but that's one of these guys that David has success through the Lord's power, through the Lord's strength at overcoming in terms of expanding the territory of Israel. Now I'm going to put a map up as we kind of look a little bit more in more detail. These aren't inspired, so I wouldn't say that any of the stuff that's on this map, other than the general location of things, is necessarily completely accepted. There's different maps that you'll find by different authors. The section that is pretty much uniformly accepted would be everything but the Tan section up at the top, that Aram section. There's some amount of dispute over how much of that northern part David was able to add to the land of the nation of Israel during his lifetime versus how much was finalized by Solomon. Different people will draw this slightly differently. A lot of them will have about halfway through that Tan. A lot of them will suggest that that's about as far north as David went. And then the rest of the distance to the Euphrates River was actually consolidated by Solomon. So I don't know if this is the kind of thing that interests you or not, but here's a map of this so that you can try to sort of picture it in terms of what are we even talking about here. Now, of course, Israel here is alongside the Mediterranean Sea. Present-day Israel is all to the west of the Jordan River there that connects. Let's see if this works. Okay, so this is the Jordan River right here, and this side of it is where present day Israel is, and then on. That's why, by the way, when people are calling for the eradication of Israel and they're chanting from the river to the sea, the largely Palestinian chant, although it's been incorporated by a lot of people now who are just anti-Israel, they're saying from the river to the sea. What space do they want? They want Israel to be wiped off the map. It's their way of trying to be cute or pleasant about saying Israel should be destroyed completely. That's all they're really saying. So if you've ever on the news lately with all of this anti-Semitism that's going on even in this country, when they're chanting from the river to the sea, that's what they're talking about. This river Jordan to the Mediterranean Sea. So in any event, let's dive into this a little bit more. I'll point up there periodically so we see some of these places that we just read about. See, these chapters record the fulfillment of God's promised victory over David's enemies. They are essentially an extension of the Davidic covenant from chapter 17, as they're sort of summarizing the outcome of God making some of these promises. Now, remember that God promised to subdue all of David's enemies. Turn back to chapter 17. I want to show you where this is a part of the promises God that were just being summarized that God had made to David. It's chapter 17, verse 10. We read this: since that time that I commanded judges to be over my people Israel, skip that part, that's just finishing verse 9. Also, so part B here, also I will subdue all your enemies. I will subdue all your enemies. That was one of the many promises or several aspects of the promises that God had made to David. I will subdue all your enemies. And I'll build a dynasty. I'll build you a house. We saw that word house is in reference to a lasting dynasty. See, David was successful. And if this is the only thing you take away tonight because this is boring to you, that doesn't offend me at all. I just would say, take this away then, this part. David was successful because God was with him and helped him. You think about, what am I going to get from the Old Testament that would be useful in my life? David's success was tied to God's help, God's assistant, God fighting battles, God's presence, God being with him. If you take nothing away, it's not David that's the focus of this summary of his life. It's his God. It's God that's the focus of this. A promise keeping, a promise making, and a promise keeping God. That's the kind of God that David has and that you have, because it's the same God, a promise keeping God. So David was successful because God was with him. See, the focus is always the faithfulness of God. It's not man's accomplishments. You could easily read this and say, this is a summary of the highlights of David's successes. This is the little caption when we go to the Hall of Fame of believers. If I went to the Believers Hall of Fame instead of the, say, Baseball Hall of Fame, when I went in there, I'd see different characters, and then in the summary under their life would be what? Their achievements. And in that list of achievements, you might read these chapters and be like, yeah, he conquered this and conquered this and conquered this and built this and did this. And that's not the emphasis. David's just a guy. A guy just like you. He's just somebody who is flawed. Somebody who doesn't get it right all the time, but somebody who had an opportunity to live life with a personal God and to trust that God to lead and provide and direct with whatever it was that he was facing, whether it was problems in his home. Did David have that? Yes. Problems with sin. Did David have that? Yes. Did he have problems with enemies outside attacking him? Yes. Did he have people subverting him in his workplace, in the kingdom? Yes. Did he deal with those kinds of things? Absolutely. He did. Just like you may be our tonight. You say, I don't know how I'm going to get out of this jam that I'm in right now. And you know, the truth of it is that you might not. God doesn't promise that you will get out of it, squirm out from under it like we talked about on Sunday. But he says, I'll be with you. I'll give you all the grace that you need to stand and live in my grace while you're going through that. And so I hope that's a takeaway that we're getting even from the very beginning here. It's the faithfulness of God that's the focus. Now, the historical record of God providing David victory bolsters confidence that he will do the same thing with David's future descendant, the Messiah. So realize that as the story is being told, it's not so much to retell the story as it is to give hope. That if God made a promise to David and then kept it, and he made promises about the future of Israel, if he made promises about your future, if he made promises about how this story ends, then we can have hope as we see his faithfulness in the past, that he'll keep those promises in the future. And that's one of the things that really has been jumping out at me as I'm looking at this. Now, in terms of the nitty-gritty, various conquests are listed in summary fashion here. And the victories, I think this is neat to note, the victories listed extend to all points of the compass, north, south, east, and west, as God is even taking ground zero here and he's building out from that. And you think about even spiritual victories. God wants to have enough of an impact on us that we can enjoy him, live life with him, be available to him to then work through, so that there can be a ripple effect of that from our life into the lives of other people around us. How does it go in terms of the anticipated outflow or movement of the gospel message? How is it put? You'll be witnesses to me in Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, and the uttermost parts of the earth or the world. Sort of a similar thing here, as you're seeing. Here we have what was sort of this middle area here where you have Judah and Israel. This was established under Saul, but we're going to go in every direction from there to expand it more. And let's start with the first one, defeat of the Philistines. Chapter 18 now, we'll pick up with verse 1. Remember that some of this, again, isn't in specific order. Chapter 18 more so talks about the start of this, and then we're going to jump around a little, get into some parts of 19 and 20, different examples of how these conquests played out. So, verse 1, it happened after this that Nahash, let's see here. After this, it came to pass that David attacked the Philistines, subdued them, and took Gath and its towns from the hand of the Philistines. So we have the Philistines to the west, right here. So if this is north, south, here's west. We have this section here that is being addressed right now. There's conflict there that's taking place there, but there's defeat. And there's a second part to this. If we'll turn to chapter 20. There's four verses talking about, I'll call it, the defeat of the Philistines, part 2. Picking up in verse 4 of chapter 20. Now it happened afterward that the war broke out at Gezer with the Philistines. At which time, I'm not even going to try these names. Well, you know I'm going to just for the humor of it. Sibrachiah and Hushathite killed Sipiah, who was one of the sons of the giant, and they were subdued. Again, there was war with the Philistines, and Elhanan, the son of Jair, killed Lahmi, the brother of Goliath, the Gittite, the shaft of whose spear was like a weaver's beam, meaning big. Verse 6, yet again there was war at Gath, where there was a man of great stature with 24 fingers and toes. You can't make this stuff up. 6 on each hand and 6 on each foot. And he also was born to the giant. So meaning the giants descended, it's thought, from one particular individual, the Philistine giants. So when he defied Israel, Jonathan, the son of Shimei, David's brother, killed him. These were born to the giant in Gath. And they fell by the hand of David and by the hand of his servants. Now, just even as it relates to this. So he had six fingers on each hand and 6 toes on each hand. And if the math's right, 24 there. I had a cat with 6 toes on each foot. So similar, but not a giant, actually a dwarf of a cat. But 24 fingers and toes. Now, possibly it's not Possibly it's not that unique, but I would think it's pretty unique. There wouldn't be too many examples of this. Why does the Bible give this detail? Because it's a story. It's a real. You think about stories. Sometimes you think some people don't even want me to use the word story because it implies that it's made up. But there's true stories, and there's fictional stories. And this is a true story. And so the details are here because it's based on reality. It's based on actual events that took place. So as we kind of think about this and break this down, we have giants that take center stage there in the second part. But note the connections there to David's past. As you're thinking about where of Goliath, who's mentioned even. Now, where was he from? Gath. Goliath from Gath. Now, his brother is now a part or features prominently in this second section here as, yeah, the brother of Goliath is named Lami. And there's actually some debate about, there's a textual variant there where it's said differently in Samuel. And so they wonder if that's actually his name or not versus, in any event, read about it yourself, I guess, but. Interesting connections. Now come to chapter 18, verse 2. Get back to where we were at. Then, so there we have the west. Now we're going to look at the Moabites. Then he defeated Moab, and the Moabites became David's servants and brought tribute. So where are the Moabites? Well, they're on the east. Now, they're not running the whole length of Israel and Judah, but Philistines on the west, Moab here on the east. This is now going to be added to the lands or the control of Israel. Then if we keep reading in verse 3, we see that David defeated Hadadezer, the king of Zobah, as far as Hamath. Okay, well, it's not on this map, but Hamath is up here somewhere. And this is where it said, this is the king of Aram Zobah. This is what we're talking about in this area, in here. Now, one of the other maps has Hamath, but I'm pretty sure it's like in here, right around here somewhere. And so now we're going north. We're looking up to the north. Now, just so we know, these people coming from Aram are also called Arameans, and they're all Syrians. There's a bunch of different groups of Syrians that all make up Syria. It wasn't consolidated the same way that it is now, as far as Syria being one unified nation, or maybe they were kind of one unified nation, but they had different clans to it. And so as you read, you're going to read about Syrians being involved in this in other places. It's not the Aramean part of the Syrians. It's another group, or however you would put that. They're not the same people, meaning verse 3 here, the Hadadezer group is different from the group you read about later. Now what happens next is another group to look at is chapter or verse 12 and 13 we looked at and we read about this section here that involved Edom. So we have Edom. So we have the Arameans to the north. Now we have Edom to the south, and it's actually southeast. And so what do we have? We have west, east. I have this backwards. Yeah, this is east, west, southwest, north. Am I getting that right? I need the actual dial up there. Is that exactly opposite? Okay, exactly opposite of that. For you at home, disregard that. Disregard that. So, yes, east here. Am I right now? Okay, east here, west, south, north. There's our compass directions. For those of you here to learn something besides Bible, that's for you. Okay, and apparently for me, too. So, we have Edom to the southeast, and that's what the last two verses we read about there, about Abishiah, the son of Zeruiah, killed 18,000 Edomites. Okay, the Edomites became David's servants. That's just another extension about we're going around the cardinal directions of the compass with all of these different places that God is providing victory. That's the takeaway, so that God is providing victory. Now, starting in chapter 19, we have more Syrians involved with the Ammonites. The Ammonites hire some Syrians to try to help them. And we'll read about it a little bit here because it's interesting. Chapter 19, let's just read. Let's see, how much of this do we want to read? Well, it's the whole chapter, but let's just read a little bit about it here in the beginning of the chapter. It happened after this that Nahash, the king of the people of Ammon, died. And his son reigned in his place, verse 2. Then David said, I will show kindness to Hanun, the son of Nahash, because his father showed kindness to me. So David sent messengers to comfort him concerning his father. And David's servants came to Hanun in the land of the people of Ammon to comfort him. Well, what happens in verse 3? And the princes of the people of Ammon said to Hanun, do you think that David really honors your father because he has sent comforters to you? Did his servants not come to you to search and to overthrow and to spy out the land? And so then they mistreat these gentlemen. Therefore, Hanun took David's servants, shaved them, which they always had their beards, shaved them, and cut off their garments in the middle at their buttocks and sent them away. I wasn't there, but I guess what I'm picturing here seems very distasteful. It seems like the kind of thing that would be would cause them to be embarrassed and ashamed to go back to their people. And we don't even understand the cultural implications of the beard being shaved. Very few of us would have any idea about the cultural side of that. But I mean, he sent them out with their cheeks in the wind. And that's not going to be received well, is how this turns out. So I'm not going to read all of chapter 19 is telling this story, right into the beginning of chapter 20. So for the sake of time, we're not going to read all that. If you want to read about how it all works out, it ends up causing a battle, of which David, with God fighting on his side, conquers Ammon, defeats the hired guns that they've brought into this, the Syrians that are used to help them. They're all defeated when it's all said and done. The Syrians flee. Many people lose their lives in this conflict. And the nation of Israel and David come out victorious when it's all said and done. And so you read about, let's read the last three verses from chapter 20. Sorry, the first three verses of chapter 20, but they end the story. They add to the story, I guess I'll say, because this still has to do with the original battle against the Ammonites. This is sort of the conclusion of it. So there's a break in the action. Let's read verse 19. And when the servants of Hadadezer saw that they were defeated by Israel, they made peace with David and became his servants. So the Syrians were not willing to help the people of Ammon anymore. So he's talking about the Syrians again get involved in this, trying to help the people of Ammon, but they all end up losing. Then there's a break, and now we pick up another part of the conflict. And for your references, if you want to read about this in the original text, you can read about this in Samuel chapter 12. Now, if you have a study Bible, it's already going to tell you that. The first part of this is 2 Samuel chapter 10. This is 2 Samuel chapter 12, the second part of this. So it happened in the spring of the year, so weather conditions now permitting more of these conflicts to take place. At the time kings go out to battle, that Joab led out the armed forces and ravaged the country of the people of Ammon and came and besieged Rabbah, the city. But David stayed at Jerusalem, and Joab defeated Rabbah and overthrew it. Then David took their king's crown from his head and found it to weigh a talent of gold, and there were precious stones in it. And it was set on David's head. Also he brought out of the spoil of the city in great abundance. And he brought out of the people who were in it and put them to work with saws and iron picks and with axes. Almost sounds like a chain gang. So David did to all the cities of the people of Ammon. Then David and all the people returned to Jerusalem. So there's sort of two parts to it, but it ends in the total defeat of the people of Ammon. So as again, you're looking at our map here. So here they are. So also on the same side of things as really Edom and Moab, but here's Ammon. There's this city that's talked about or discussed as being overthrown by David. So we have here also east side of the Jordan. That's called the Trans-Jordan Plain is what that's referred to, if I'm remembering it right. So a couple of things to note about this section, because you're like, man, this is not anything to take away. The takeaway of the defeat of these Ammonites and more Syrians mixed in there, I would say there's a couple of things. We read the verses here to start chapter 19. One of the things that jumped out at me is the danger that comes with being overly suspicious. The danger that comes with assuming evil motives in people. It led to the downfall of the entire Ammonite nation. David had no ill will toward them. He was going to treat them graciously on behalf of this relationship he'd already established with the father, Nahash. So, by being overly suspicious, assuming evil motives in people when there's no actual evidence of that, what is the outcome? Well, it turns out to be very, very bad. And I was thinking even about our own lives, how easy it is to have some negative things happen where we start to project that negativity into every relationship we have. Now, it's natural. If you've been hurt by somebody or hurt by people, it's easy to be guarded and to some extent healthy probably or safe to do that. But if you're not careful, what can happen is that you begin to view everybody as having secondary motives just because you've come into or encountered somebody who at some point in your life did. Well, that's just not even the case. But if we start to think like that, all of a sudden we become, I don't know if paranoid is the right word for it, but we start to just have that gut reaction to people, and it gets in the way of us having the intimacy and closeness of relationship that God wants us to have with people that he puts in our life, or even ways that he wants to provide for us through people in our life or meet our needs. Another thing that I really like about this is, as you think about, where's the verse for it? Chapter 19, verse 13. So if you're in chapter 19, go back a little bit. This is a pep talk that is given. This is being spoken by the commander, Abishai. But this is really insightful. He says, "Be of good courage, and let us be strong for our people and for the cities of our God, and may the Lord do what is good in his sight." Now, there's a bunch of things you can observe there. One, that courage comes from trusting God. Another thing to take away from that is that there's no presumptiveness in this. He's taking God at his word, but he's also allowing for God to show him something different. God has said, "I'm with you. You're going to be successful," to David in general, but this flows down to other people within his leadership team. And so he has confidence on one hand. He says, we can be of good courage. We can be strong for the cities of our God. It's a personal God. But then he also ends with that, may the Lord do what is good in his sight. Even if it doesn't turn out the way I expect it to, I can still trust the Lord. I can still count on him. And I don't think that we do that too often. I think we say effectively, Lord, I will have my faith strengthened if the outcomes are what I wanted them to be. Instead of, Lord, my faith is going to be strong in you because of your character and your faithfulness in the past, regardless of how this particular trial turns out. Now, here's just another passing thing. Go back to chapter 20, verse 2. This is just another one of those details that jumps off the page. But it says they captured this crown, and it weighed a talent of gold, and it had these precious stones in it. If you do the math on it, a talent of gold weighs approximately 66 pounds. I just wanted you to picture having this put on your head. It was set on David's head, 66 pounds of gold. Now, he clearly didn't wear it around often, or he had probably, if he did, he would have, it would have been like weight training all the time. But a 66-pound gold crown. Now, apparently, I looked at it a little bit more. They said that it was common for these ornate crowns. They weren't really meant to be worn. They were meant to be for show. And they were suspended by gold chains above the king's throne, is what happened with those types of crowns. All right. Now, I want to shift gears. Those are summaries of some of these military victories that are sort of the focus of this section, if you set aside the fact that the focus is really on God being a promise-keeping God. You could just read right past this stuff because it's all just confirming what God already promised to do. And now here's the evidence of it. It's being written to this post-exilic community. It's intended to give them hope. That's the real summary of this. But these victories provided various benefits to Israel nationally beyond just the expansion of their borders. And I want to touch on that a little bit here to wrap up the rest of our time. They ended up gathering together a lot of military resources as a result of this. Look at even the example we read in chapter 18, verse 4, when we read those first 13 verses. He took from him, this other leader, 1,000 chariots. And then goes on to talk about horsemen and foot soldiers. He took them from him. That's pretty significant. It doesn't sound like, from the reading I was able to do, that the nation of Israel had yet incorporated this type of warfare into their battle plans, where they didn't use or hadn't been using chariots yet. And I don't know how that story ends. I'm not an expert on that. But other nations did. And so it sounds like, to some extent, David now has this opportunity to reinforce his own armaments with this, which God had provided by way of victory. The other thing that you'll see throughout this, and I'm going to summarize a bunch of them by pointing you to a few examples, is these victories provided Israel with, nationally, with financial prosperity. So military, an expansion of land, borders, military resources they didn't previously have, financial prosperity. So we saw that in verse 2, the Moabites brought tribute. We saw that in verse 6, the Syrians became David's servants and brought tribute. This means money is coming into the nation. We saw in verse 7, David took the shields of gold that were on the servants of Hadadezer and brought them to Jerusalem. We saw in verse 8 that David brought a large amount of bronze with which Solomon made the bronze sea, the pillars, and the articles of bronze in verse 8. And again, that's there. They're going to be covered in greater detail in chapters 22 through 29 about the preparation for the temple. But that's, I believe, why that's included. In verse 11, we saw that King David also dedicated these to the Lord, along with the, read this now, the silver and gold that he brought from all these nations, from Edom, from Moab, from the people of Ammon, from the Philistines, and from Amalek. And so all of these different things, these victories, they come with financial prosperity that's going to aid the nation of Israel, in addition to the expanded borders and the military resources. The other thing that you're going to see, and we touched on it already in what we read in chapter 18, is that these victories also brought with them peace with other nations. Read, just glance back enough to read it again, but in verses 9 through 10 there, it talks about how this Tuo, the king of Hamath, he heard of this. And so he sent these gifts. He sent these resources and this blessing and this greeting to King David. Now, it doesn't specifically say this, but that was a peace offering being made that resulted in peace between Israel and some of the other nations. They're called Hamathites because it was the king of Hamath. Now, the last thing to point out in terms of other benefits that came to Israel as a result of these victories is found in chapter 20, verse 3. We already read this, too. What came from this is an additional workforce. An additional workforce. Verse 3 says, he brought out the people who were in Ammon and put them to work with saws, with iron picks, and with axes. Now, that led to the strengthening of the nation. It led to projects being accomplished, the nation growing bigger in scale and grandeur to some extent than it had been previously. Now, I don't want this to be lost. I've mentioned it a few times already tonight. But remember that the Lord is responsible for these successes. And it's said twice in the 13 verses that we read in chapter 18. In verse 6, it says, so the Lord preserved David wherever he went. And in verse 13, it says, and the Lord preserved David wherever he went. The chronicler doesn't want that to get lost in a history lesson. He doesn't want you to walk away from here saying, I now know which direction east and west is. Or I now know some details about some of these other areas that the nation of Israel expanded to when David was the king. That would be to miss the whole point. The whole point is that this is evidence. These are examples. This is illustrations of God keeping his promises. The Lord preserved David. It's kind of interesting to me, just another comment, that David's connection to battle or war is later listed as a reason he will not be allowed to build the temple when God is providing these victories. But there was something about that that was determined by the Lord to be not a good fit then to take part in the actual building of the temple. And you can read about that. We'll look at it when we get there. But chapter 22, verse 8, chapter 28, verse 3, you can read ahead and see that. Now, the other takeaway that I hope is jumping off the page is you're looking at nations. We sometimes have this idea that we overemphasize the importance of nations in God's grand scheme. And part of the reason is that's all we would know in our humanity. But here's a nation. A nation, a nation, a nation, a nation, right? And then a nation in the middle here. What's the takeaway here? No nation is going to stand in the way of God's plans. No nation is going to frustrate God's plans. I think one of the things that jumped out to me, God is bigger than any nation. God is, even if the whole nation stands in opposition to God's plans, God can raise up kings, take down kings, raise up kingdoms, take down kingdoms. You can see it throughout history that there's nothing fixed about any of it. It's subject to change. The only thing that never changes is God. The only thing that will never change is that God has a plan that's not going to be thwarted by human beings, including entire nations. And I hope that's encouraging to you to see that as you see a lot of conflict in the world. You see a lot of turmoil. Not going to be any kind of an issue for an all-powerful God. Nothing's going to stop him, he's saying to these exiles who have been taken captives by the Babylonians, the rest of the nation of Israel, the Israel side of the split kingdom between Judah and Israel, have been taken by the Assyrians. It's of no consequence to God in terms of him fulfilling his plans and keeping his promises. He is a limitless God. Now, the other thing that's summarized here, and it won't take us long, just a few verses here, is David's administration is summarized. So we have a summary here of these God-provided, God-empowered conquests and victories that we have in terms of the expansion of territory. But then the only other part of this that we skipped over and are coming back to now is David's administration is summarized in chapter 18, verses 14 through 18. Now, as I look at the clock, for the sake of time, we're not even going to read this. I'll let you read that on your own because there's nothing real deep about it. It just happens to be that there's a listing given here about some of the people that are a part of David's leadership team. It starts with 14. So David reigned over all Israel and administered judgment and justice to all his people. Now, if this is an idealized picture of the coming King of Kings, what can we expect? And there's other prophecies about this. The justice will be coming with him. Judgment will be coming. Those are things associated with the Messiah, too. And so that's, I think, why this is listed, is that it's said to be true of David. But remember, this is an idealized David as a picture of the new David that will be coming. And so then there's a number of different people who are in his cabinet, various officials that hold these key governmental offices that are listed. One, just pure curiosity to me, I just only pointed out because I never knew of this. Never had read it or seen this before. In verse 17, some portion of the army that David had were foreign professional soldiers. You could call them mercenaries. And that's what's referred to here when it talks about these Cherethites and the Pelethites that are being led or directed by the son of Jehoiada, Benaiah. Benaiah was over the Cherethites and the Pelethites, and the more I read about it, these were foreign soldiers that were professional soldiers that were a part of David's army, what became the fighting force for the nation of Israel. Pretty incredible. I don't know what more to make of it other than it's just a side note for those of you who like to learn those bits of trivia that you'd otherwise read past. So here again, we have another installment of this idealized David. Again, I've said it tonight, I'll say it again as we finish out the life of David here. The picture here is that there's going to be a need for, not a need, well, a need for a restoring king, a king of kings, a new David, a king that's not just being idealized in a sense of glossing over some of the failure, although we'll hit on failure next week, but a perfect king, something that was missing in any human king. And so as you think about the list of all of the different kings of Israel, and there's going to be more of that discussed in 2 Chronicles when we get there. Why are all of these people listed? Why are all of these stories told? Well, because the picture is it doesn't matter who the human variation is of that king, it's going to be flawed because sin passed to all men, spread to all men. All have sinned, all are sinners. So there's only examples of failure or those that are less than perfect or less than ideal. That's why we have to idealize somebody here in Chronicles, because there was no such thing as an ideal king, because it should make us have this idea that we need the perfect king. Not just Israel, but we need to have our confidence and trust in the one who is perfect, recognizing that we're flawed. We need God to actually be sufficient where we're insufficient, to live through us in a way that would please him, knowing that we wouldn't be capable of that in our own strength. And there's hope there. Here, the intended group of recipients of this book are the exiles, but there's hope for us too, not just in time that we could have that victory when he's working in our lives, but also hope that our future is just as bright as the hope that's being reminded, that these exiles are being reminded of as well. Let's pray. Dear Heavenly Father, thank you for this time we could spend here in your word. Thank you for allowing us to summarize another few chapters here of 1 Chronicles. Pray that there had been something in there of benefit to us in terms of learning your word, but also in terms of being reminded of some biblical principles that are transdispensational. They're forever principles that never change.